This past Saturday evening, longtime peace activist and beloved community member Ruth McKay passed away in Concord, New Hampshire. Last December, Making Waves interviewer Brian Gregg spoke with Ruth prior to her yearly protest against weapons manufacturer BAE Systems in Nashua, New Hampshire. In memory and celebration of the inspiring and heartfelt work that Ruth dedicated much of her life to, we are playing this interview again today.
As of our broadcast today, a 30-hour vigil is currently ongoing at the BAE Systems manufacturing plant on Spitbrook Road in Nashua. A resistance action has been held annually there for more than 20 years. This year's vigil was scheduled to start yesterday at 11 in the morning and end today at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. BAE Systems, based in the UK with more than 90,000 employees around the world, is a major player in the business of war. Its products include military aircraft, ships, submarines, space systems, and guided weapons. The local branch of the company, which started in Nashua in 1951 as Sanders Associates, was acquired first by Lockheed Martin in 1986, then by BAE in the year 2000. The Nashua facility is the headquarters of the company's Information and Electronic Warfare Systems Division. The BAE stock price has risen 79% since the U.S.-led coalition invaded Iraq. On Thursday, I had the privilege of interviewing Ruth McKay of Concord. She's 85 years old and one of the founders of the resistance action in 1983. Currently on dialysis and dealing with complications from angina of the heart. Ms. McKay plans to attend this year's vigil in a wheelchair with the help of her grandson. Ruth McKay, what first inspired you to start a resistance action at the Nashua plant?
Oh, I think because for years and years, I'm embarrassed to say probably, 40 years, I mean, a really long time. I just drove by the place. And in the beginning, I was really happy they were providing jobs after the textile mills went out. And I just didn't stop to think what they made. I just thought electronic whatever sounded romantic and reaching into the future in a good way. But after a while, I really had to face up to what they made there. And I thought, I just can't keep doing this. I retired in 83, in October, and with my friend Macy and my husband, we started, at the beginning of Advent, we started vigiling, just what meant holding a banner in front of the entrance.
And what's planned for this year's action?
This year is pretty interesting because I just couldn't imagine anything more dramatic or more wonderful than last year's when 11 of us, it was a big crowd, but out of the crowd, 11 of us chained ourselves together across the entrance to the executive building. And I thought, this has got to be the peak of whatever. How could we ever think of anything better than this? And then as the group met, I wasn't able to because of my health issues, but that everybody kept me in touch. And as they met, they said, well, why don't we go in the other direction and not even have CD this year? We'll just have a long, long vigil for 30 hours, Friday into Saturday. And nobody will do it on the sidewalk where it's legal. We'll check with our attorney that's advising us and check with the local police. That has been done. And everybody says our plans are acceptable. And the police will be there to make sure that other people don't harm us. So that's pretty quite wonderful.
And what was the result of the action last year?
Well, we were arrested and had to go to court. And in the court, that was interesting, too, because most years I've gone to jail after doing something like this. But the last few, the judges, they really hate to put old lady peace people in jail. You know, it's pretty embarrassing. And so they found ways, like they say so-and-so's evidence conflicts with somebody else's, therefore we'll dismiss the case. Or they'll say, let's say last year the prosecutor kept saying, going to jail is not one of your options. And we said, but we don't pay fines. Doesn't that mean we have to go to jail? Going to jail is not one of your options. He just wouldn't. And so he gave us choice between fine and community service.
And so did you all end up needing to do community service as a result of that?
Yeah, none of us paid a fine. That's an agreement we're pretty firm on. We also don't bond ourselves at the beginning of the trial. And because we've done it so long, the police and the courts know that's how it will be. So I'm sure they got together and said, well, what can we do with these guys? So they gave us a choice of fines or community service. My community service was really interesting. Want me to tell you about that? I chose to organize 80-year-olds in resistance to war, and I said I would like to have that organizational time and effort count as my community service to let the community know how 80 plus we called ourselves, and the judge allowed it.
That's amazing. And I'd like to ask you about, you mentioned the police are aware of plans for this year and so on. How have your resistance actions generally been received by the local police in Nashua?
The first time, everybody was really nervous, and we were too, because it was the first time that civil disobedience had done anywhere except Seabrook. And Seabrook, the same thing happened there. The people's manners and the way they did things and their persistence, that judge wouldn't put anybody in jail either. And so we did have that. Some of us had taken part over there. We did have that to encourage us. And I forgot your question already.
Relationship with the police?
Oh, yeah. We met with the police and with Sanders Security for breakfast before the first one even. No, not before the women, but after the women's action and when it turned out to be for men and women both.
And you were saying that it started as a women's action particularly?
We had 2 years when it was just women. 13 women were arrested the first time. And the second time, most of those women they felt going to jail was a waste of time. They should be organizing. I was the only one of the 13 that wanted to keep doing something. And another woman joined me. So two of us threw blood and tears, blood for the loss of life and tears for the terrible sorrow of what was going on. And we threw blood on the steps going into the building and were arrested for that.
That was the building at Sanders?
On Canal Street, yes.
And you've been doing an action at BAE and its predecessor companies for more than 20 years. Do you have a sense of what effect your group's actions have had on people who pass by on the street or learn about it from press accounts?
Yeah, I feel it's been very, very favorable. And I find it very convincing that this has happened. Because in the beginning, people were always saying, go back to Russia, or, you know, said nasty things. And that never happens now. It's more like toot for a yes, yes, and or at least just kind of open-eyed wonder and attention. So that, gee, I get it. What's going on here? I need to think about this. I think both of those reactions are really very positive.
And how about the effect of the resistance actions on the company itself, the BAE? Has it ever addressed your concerns directly or even acknowledged the action with some kind of response?
Well, we did used to meet with the vice president and talk things over, and usually that would be the vice president in the personnel department. And then the somewhere near the beginning, we asked to meet with the president, the local president, John Craik. And he said, I don't need to meet with you. I already know what you think. So and that connection faded. But it did move down to the local security person on the ground, Leo Belzano. And he and I have just become really dear friends. We just love each other.
And Mr. Belzano works for the security section of the BAE company?
Yes. Seems like every year he's gone up a notch in responsibility, so it hasn't hurt his job to be friendly to us.
How about the workers themselves at the BAE plant? How have you had a sense of their reaction to your actions?
Yeah, I feel as though it's much more mellow, but also I am too. Like, I feel as though I'm where I belong, so I'm relaxed. And sometimes I meet people that I already know from church or from community affairs, and we're able to talk to each other like human beings, each accepting where the other one is at. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thanks. And you're going through dialysis, as I mentioned, and you're planning to attend this year's vigil in a wheelchair with the help of your grandson. What motivates you now to get out in the cold and at a time when many people would just as soon rest, you know, in a warm place?
Well, in the first place, I'm not so much the resting personality, so of course that is part of the reasons I'm there. And also, I just bought this as my problem that I must work on. And knowing that I'll live and die and they'll still be there probably, but maybe not. I mean, some remarkable things do happen. My grandson, Jared, who lives, that's my son's son, he has the same thoughts I do, but he had a lot of trouble answering the main question that we have. Why do you do it? You know, I mean, they still keep doing their job. So why do you do this, which just gets you into trouble? And he had a hard time accepting that. He didn't like to think of his grandmother in jail. But this year, he said, I'm doing it for you, Grammy. And he's going to push my chair. And his best friend from Conway is going to be with him.
Mm-hmm. And did you sort of raise your children with an activeness or an activist consciousness? And is that something that they've passed on to their kids? Or is this more of just a special connection between your grandson and you for more, you know, personal reasons?
Well, actually, you go back to the beginning of what you said, it was the other way around. It was my children that got me going, because I was a very typical rural Republican conservative and believed that to be good meant you please people and you're nice to people. And I paid attention to the things at Seabrook and eventually did take part. But it was my own teenagers in my family, my son and daughter, and I taught the high school class, and one of the boys in the class said, either you believe all this love stuff or you don't, you know, which is it? And so they're the ones that really got me going. And my daughter refused to lead the Memorial Day parade, and that woke everybody up, because that was a big thing and it involved our church and our family. And I thought, oh, Peter tells me I should think about loving everybody. And Chrissy says I ought to act on that as if I meant it. And my son refused to register for the draft. So it was they that spurred me.
And Peter and Chrissy are your son and daughter?
Now, Peter was in my Sunday school class, and Chris is my daughter. My son is Daddy, the father of Jared, the wheelchair pusher.
Right. And By the way, I just want to turn to more, you know, while we're on more personal areas. Where did you grow up, and how did you end up in the area of, I guess, Nashua, where you used to live?
Well, I was born in Concord because that's where my mother had her babies, but I grew up on a farm in Hooksett, just downriver from here. Married a high school friend, and he got a job. He went to school at Northeastern, and his co-op job was at Johns Manville in Nashua. And so that's where we moved, and that's where I found a teaching job.
And if you could sort of, maybe you have, had a conversation with your grandchildren about the kind of values that you'd like to see them pass on, say, to their grandchildren, if they should have them. I don't know if you've had conversations like that, or if you did, what might you tell them?
Well, I think the conversation that is more like the one you're asking about would be with my grandson Jared, because we seem to have a lot in common about our vision of what life can be, and because I've seen him struggle with choices for a career for himself, because he knows it'll be really hard to support himself on music and poetry, you know, at least in the beginning. But he seems to have made that decision, and I just find that really admirable. So there again, I think I get more from him than I give him. Or we support each other, really. But the other grandnephews and grandchildren are more cautious and careful and uncomfortable, and they don't really want to get into all this spiritual stuff.
And you've mentioned the role of your faith in informing your actions toward peace. I wonder if you can just kind of explain that, how that works for you.
Oh, I'd be happy to. Because for me, my religion is to be a loving person. And as a Christian, I feel that's what Jesus was trying to do. Said, you can, it is possible to be loving no matter what other people do to you, and no matter what's going on around you. You can be loving. It doesn't say it'll turn out so hot, because it certainly didn't for him. There can be a lot of suffering with it, but it's the only way that really can work, is to be loving. And if you stick to it forever, then you do see progress. And I have seen that progress. In my statement that I used when the last time I went to court, I was talking about the New Hampshire Constitution. I used that for my defense. And in the Bill of Rights, there is Article 5 that says the state cannot encourage any, cannot tell a person how to express their religion. And so based on that, I cannot separate my churchmanship from my peace work. There is no way I can do that. They just go together. And one of the examples I gave was that when I do these actions of breaking the law with BAE, I do it as an offering to God, because there is some sacrifice. I'll have to go to jail, and you know that, and the strain of going through it is a sacrifice. But it's an offering to God in exactly the same way as in worship, when they pass the offering plate and I put money in the offering plate for God's work. This is exactly the same thing for me. I'm offering this action as a gift to God. Does that make sense to you?
It does, yes. And I wonder, you know, like before this interview, you and I were speaking about conversations with other people, say in your family, who may be religious but have a different perspective on what that means in terms of their actions. And of course, and their family, and you love them, and you know, and you find a way to work together. And I wonder if what your sort of point of view is on how differently people can construct what it means to be, let's say, a Christian or any other religion for that matter, and how people can draw such different conclusions from essentially the same text and largely the same traditions.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. That's a hard question. I don't know how to answer that because I wonder about it myself. Like, I'm different from my siblings. There were four of us, and my two brothers and my sister don't have that kind of drive that I have, partly personality, but partly, I mean, I really take my religion seriously, and I always did, even as a little kid. I always felt, we had two great aunts that lived in the same house, and they talked to me a lot when I was growing up, and a lot of the talk was about God, who knew everything I did. But it was not a scary God that was watching over me and was going to grab me if I did something terrible or make me fall down and bump my knee or none of that stuff. It was just a God who was watching over me, just like my great aunts and my parents and my grandparents, wanting me to be a loving person. And that I was lucky because that was the emphasis that came to me as a child. I never was taught about a scary, I'm going to get you God. It was always a loving, caring God that wanted me to be at my best, meaning most loving.
I'd like to end with, if you're willing to read from the letter that you wrote to the editor of The Telegraph of Nashua, please.
I am an 85-year-old New Hampshire woman who for over 20 years has stood vigil in front of the weapons manufacturer BA Systems in Nashua. Each year I've asked why, so today I try to answer that question. Why do I stand vigil? Why do I stand at BAE? Because every day another soldier dies, another child goes hungry, another family mourns their losses. Because these are the true costs of war. Today, I read the number of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq is up to 1,256, probably more now. Six of those are from New Hampshire. As it is official policy of the U.S. government not to count the dead of our enemy, it is harder to find the number of Iraqi dead. But a recent article in the prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, reported the number to be at least 100,000, most of those women and children. 100,000 Iraqis dead. 1,256 Americans dead. The cost of war. I also read at least 9,326 soldiers have been wounded in Iraq. But since the Pentagon only reports those wounded in action, I can only imagine what the true number is and how many, like veterans of the first Gulf War, are returning home with exposure to depleted uranium radiation, a post-traumatic stress syndrome. I have read that over 35 GIs have committed suicide in Iraq or upon returning home. Although, again, the Pentagon does not keep those records either. Wounded on the outside and wounded on the inside, the cost of war. There's also a financial cost to war. We've spent over $147 billion on the war and occupation of Iraq. That is $5 billion a month, over $166 million a day. New Hampshire citizens alone has spent $68 million today. To pay for this, we place a burden on those who can afford it the least, our children and our grandchildren, who will have to pay off the federal deficit, which now tops $477 billion. Our state budget, which is trying to cut Medicaid and Medicare to the poor and elderly, our cities and our towns, which must raise taxes to simply maintain level funding for our schools. The costs of war. For me, as a woman of faith, The greatest cost is the one we all share equally and painfully. The cost to our souls, our humanity. The cost of knowing the truth of what our government is doing in our names and not able to stop it. The truth, as even Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld admits, that we are creating enemies faster than we are killing them. The truth that is, every Iraqi death leads to a deeper desire for revenge, breeding rather than diminishing terrorism. The truth that violence begets violence, the war, the ultimate terrorist act, begets more terrorism. The cost of war. So this year, as we have for 20 years, we will again stand vigil in front of the weapons manufacturer BAE Systems in Nashua. We choose to stand at BAE for two reasons. BAE is one of the world's largest weapons manufacturers. It reaps tremendous financial benefits from the horrors of war, from the death of children and women, from the destruction of homes and schools. We stand in opposition to BAE, to all who profit from war. BAE is also the largest manufacturing employer in New Hampshire. The men and women who work there are talented, skilled, and caring people. We vigil in support of these workers and encourage an industry conversion from the development of weapons to the creation of life-supporting infrastructure. This year, like most years, we choose United Nations Human Rights Day. The day states that human rights should provide us with an opportunity to pay tribute to human rights educators, indeed human rights defenders, who in formal and informal settings, in small or large communities, and often encountering difficulties and hazards, contribute to the building of a universal culture of human rights. It is in this spirit that my brothers and sisters and I vigil at BAE.
Ruth McKay, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me.
I loved it.
Listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's birth when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's birth in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never, never left. The dead are not under the earth. They are in the rustling trees. They are in the groaning woods. They are in the crying grass. They are in the moaning rocks. The dead are not under the earth. So listen more often to things than to beings. Listen more often to things than to beings. 'Tis the ancestor's breath when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's breath in the voice of the waters. Those who have died have never, never left. The dead have a pact with the living. They are in the woman's breast. They are in the waiting child. They are with us in the home. They are with us in the ground. The dead have a pact with the living. bound to be. Listen more often to things than to bees. 'Tis the ancestor's birth when the fire's voice is heard. 'Tis the ancestor's birth in the voice of the water. Listen more often to things than to bees. Listen more often to things than to bees. Tis the ancestor's birth when the fire's voice is heard. Tis the ancestor's birth in the voice of the water.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Breaths. We now go to independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jim Schultz, Executive Director of the Democracy Center, who discusses major protests in Bolivia, demanding the nationalization of the country's energy resources, which led to the recent resignation of President Carlos Mesa. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Global Exchange, who looks at the British leaked Downing Street memo that many believe is a smoking gun, exposing the Bush administration's dishonest justification for launching the Iraq War. And Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future, who describes the political priorities discussed at the recent Take Back America conference, the largest gathering of progressives since the 2004 presidential election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Reuters reports that hunger is exploding in the war-ravaged Darfur province of Sudan, where violence has prevented farmers from planting crops. The United Nations World Food Program says 3.5 million people in Darfur are in need of food aid, more than half of the population. At the beginning of 2005, UN relief workers expected to provide food for 2.8 million people, but the number of hungry people has continued to rise beyond expectations. So far, 2 million have been forced to flee their homes due to violence from government-backed paramilitary units. Many are now living in camps for internally displaced persons. The International Committee for the Red Cross says it is now feeding over 320,000 people in refugee camps. The International Criminal Court has recently begun an investigation into war crimes committed in Darfur. Meanwhile, British rock star Bob Geldof is organizing a rally and a series of Live Aid concerts for July 2nd, just before the upcoming G8 summit in Scotland. The protest and concert is aimed at raising money and pressuring rich nations to cancel Africa's foreign debt and to double the level of aid to the region. President Bush has thus far rejected signing onto such an initiative promoted by his ally, British Prime Minister Tony Blair. For the first time in 20 years, Canada is debating building new nuclear power plants. Under pressure from the Kyoto Treaty on global warming and the rising cost of oil, Canada is looking for new energy sources that do not create greenhouse gases, and for some, nuclear power fits the bill. Yet, many energy experts say that nuclear energy is not reliable, as many nuclear plants have been shut down for years at a time while undergoing repairs. As Essay Sharif, a solar energy expert at the University of Florida, told the Interpress service, energy from nuclear plants remains very expensive, due to the limited global supply of uranium. On Capitol Hill, subsidies for new nuclear power plants have been tacked on to the McCain-Lieberman Climate Stewardship Act, which creates enforceable caps on carbon dioxide emissions. Many environmental groups object to funding new designs for nuclear plants and allocating $600 million to develop the new so-called clean coal technology. The aim of the nuclear subsidies is to win support for the McCain-Lieberman bill. Green lobbyists say it is a losing strategy. As Kevin Curtis of the National Environmental Trust told The Grist, an online environmental magazine, it is shifting the focus to industry handouts and away from the real solution, a strong market-based program. Researchers from the Rocky Mountain Institute say improvements in energy efficiency are 6 times more effective in terms of cost, as is nuclear power, eliminating the need to build any new nuclear energy plants. Under the media radar screen, the Bush majority on the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, has taken away the right of some workers to organize. Last November, the NLRB, led by Robert Batista, a Detroit management lawyer, reversed a 2000 labor board decision that declared that workers in temporary agencies had a similar interest to full-time workers, which made it easier for unions to recruit temp and freelance workers in the growing tech industry. Now, temp workers need the permission of their contract agency and employer for the right to organize, something that would be rarely given. According to the American Prospect magazine, the temp sector is a $62 billion business, which is expected to grow 54% by 2012. As a rule, part-time workers make $4 an hour less than full-time workers and receive few health benefits. Yet the Bush-led NLRB is intent on rolling back the workers' right to organize. Batista, the labor board chair, is a vocal critic of card check union elections, where a majority of workers need to sign union cards to win recognition. In another setback, the labor board has also stripped graduate assistants at private colleges from being able to organize into a union. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
After 2 weeks of militant protests across Bolivia demanding the nationalization of the Latin American country's energy resources, President Carlos Mesa offered his resignation in a televised address on June 6th. Mesa's resignation, the second time he's offered to step down in a year, would not take effect until accepted by Bolivia's Congress. Evo Morales, leader of Bolivia's leading opposition party, the Movement Towards Socialism, said that the resignation of President Mesa was not enough, and called for the resignation of both the Senate President and Speaker of the House. New elections could be called by a caretaker government headed by the Chief Justice of Bolivia's Supreme Court. Tens of thousands of protesters made up of miners, labor activists, and Bolivia's poor majority indigenous population had converged on Bolivia's capital city of La Paz the night President Mesa resigned. The people of La Paz have experienced food and fuel shortages as a result of road blockades erected by demonstrators in recent weeks. Although 92% of Bolivians had supported a 2004 referendum directing the government to take back control of the nation's oil and gas industries, the International Monetary Fund had threatened to withhold aid if contracts with private energy companies were challenged. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jim Schultz, executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, who analyzes the roots of the nation's popular resistance to U.S.-backed neoliberal economic policies and their connection to the wider progressive movements across Latin America.
Bolivia is the poorest country in South America. It sits atop the second largest gas and oil reserves in all of South America. And Bolivians are very concerned that they be those resources be developed in a way that average Bolivians are going to see the benefits. 10 years ago, the gas resources were privatized. The benefits go to foreign corporations like British Petroleum and others. And so there's this huge movement demanding that the oil and gas be taken over again by the government the way it used to be. The government doesn't want to do that. It's under enormous pressure from the International Monetary Fund, from companies like British Petroleum and others to leave the oil and gas in their hands. And so right now, the capital of La Paz is shut down virtually entirely by tens of thousands of protesters who come down from the indigenous areas of the highlands above the capital. Here in Cochabamba, where I live and work, the center of the city has been shut down almost every day for the last week. There's no automobile or bus traffic in or out of the city. We're closed down.
Maybe you could speak to a little bit of the history that has brought Bolivia to this point in time.
Yeah, a little context, just because because I don't think most people think of Bolivia very often except for llamas and ladies in big skirts and bowler hats. Bolivia, first of all, it's a beautiful country. It's highlands, it's jungles, it's valleys, it's got the most indigenous population in the entire Western Hemisphere. That said, Bolivia has, for the last 20 years, been the primary lab rat in Latin America for a whole set of economic policies imposed on it from abroad. I mean, if you think about the United States right now, up in the United States, you're having a big debate over what to do with Social Security. The president wants to privatize it. A lot of people are resisting that, I think, for good reason. One of the most fundamental decisions that a democracy makes is what's public and what's private. Education, health care, Social Security. Well, in Bolivia, that decision was completely taken out of the people's hands, taken really out of the government's hands, by the International Monetary Fund, who said, look, you're dependent on foreign aid. If you want foreign aid, if you want the assistance from the International Monetary Fund, here's the commandments. First, you have to privatize your natural resources, including oil and gas. Bolivia is resisting that. And so what you have actually in this country is two different social movements or big changes happening in the country at the same time. The first is a very broad popular resistance to these economic policies. And the second is, this is a country in which 60% of the population are indigenous. They are locked out of power in this country, and they are demanding that they become the stakeholders in the country and in its politics that they deserve to be. These two things have come together in the war over gas, because the indigenous populations, especially, I think, are very sensitive to what it means to have natural resources stolen out from underneath their feet.
Jim Schultz, finally, I'd like to ask you this. How does the current crisis in Bolivia, how is it connected to progressive activism and a rejection of neoliberal economic policies pushed by Washington across Latin America?
Well, that is a very important question. It's a good one to end on. I'm an American. I'm from California. And when you're from the United States at this time in history, it's easy to be a little depressed because it sure looks like the country is marching toward the right and toward a set of values that most of us don't agree with, and it's very hard to see how we're going to pull it back. Latin America is marching in the exact opposite direction. And, you know, there are a lot of reporters who come here and they all want to write the story about the new left in South America. And it's much more interesting than to call it the new left. This isn't the second coming of Che Guevara. What's happening here is not ideological. What's happening here is a very broad Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, a very broad reaction against the practical failure of a set of market fundamentalist economic policies imposed on this country from abroad and other countries as well. And, you know, I live here, and the poor who live in Latin America, they really don't have the luxury of ideology. What they want is practical solutions. Can they get water? Can their kids get educated? Can they get access to health care? Can they find a job? If these economic policies of privatization and the rest had worked, if they had delivered the goods, I think people in this continent would have embraced them. The fact that not only have they not embraced them, but in country after country these policies are being rejected is because they are a practical failure. They just don't work. They only make the lives of the poor more miserable. And that's what's happening here. And people take their politics very seriously in a place like Bolivia. They can't afford to just read about it in the newspaper or listen to it on the radio. They have to act. They have to be engaged because it affects their lives in a direct way. So I think what's happening in Bolivia is part of something that is happening all over this region, and it is really worth people in the United States, especially progressives, to try to understand what it really means.
That was Jim Schultz, Executive Director of the Democracy Center based in Cochabamba, Bolivia. Contact the center by calling their San Francisco office at area code 415-564-4767 or visit their website at www.democracyctr.org.
Medea Benjamin is a longtime peace and social justice activist. In the 1980s, she co-founded Global Exchange, a nonprofit research, education, and action center that fosters people-to-people ties around the world. After the 9/11 terrorist attack, and in response to the Bush administration's color-coded terror threat alert system, she co-founded Code Pink, a creative movement of women and men who oppose what they brand the Bush agenda of never-ending war. Benjamin spoke last week in New Haven, Connecticut, as part of a tour promoting a new book she co-edited with fellow Co-Pink activist Jody Evans, titled Stop the Next War Now, Effective Responses to Violence and Terrorism. In the following excerpt, Benjamin says that although exposure of lies and atrocities by the Bush administration has not yet triggered massive, vocal opposition to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, she is confident that a future disclosure will eventually provide that spark. One possible smoking gun she discusses is the so-called Downing Street Memo, first published in the British press on May 1st, that revealed the Bush administration had fixed its intelligence on Iraq around the policy of justifying the war. Benjamin also talks about the need to re-inspire some elements of the peace movement to realize that staying the course in Iraq just because U.S. troops are already there is not the way to peace.
Now, this kind of immorality is so directly coming from the White House and is not being discussed through the corporate media and is not trickling down to the discussion among people themselves. But it will be, and we don't know, again, what the spark will be. But there is a new document out there that should be the spark, and that is the Downing Street Memo that just came to light recently, showed that back in July 2002, the British intelligence meeting with the Bush administration and hearing that the Bush administration was determined to go in and invade Iraq no matter what, and that even though the intelligence did not justify the invasion, in fact, they said there was more of a likelihood of weapons of mass destruction in North Korea and Iran and Libya than there was in Iraq. But they would, quote, fix the intelligence to justify an invasion. Now that should set off the alarm bells all over the United States. Okay, now here we have it, the smoking gun coming directly from the intelligence services in England. But that has not sparked it either. And I say that we use that document, that we don't let that one go so quickly, that we start circulating that document. We raise money and put it in the papers. It's a short memo. But when you read the memo, I think a lot of people would say, wow, they really fixed the intelligence. And we have a very good constitutional lawyer that has just, on the basis of this memo, written a 5-page document showing how this memo is proof that George Bush conspired to deceive the U.S. Congress and the American people about the reasons for going to war. Now, in case you don't know what that means high crimes and misdemeanors. And in case you don't know what that means impeachment. Now, yes. I'm sure many of you are saying, oh yeah, nice thought, impeachment in a Republican Congress. Well, that's true. We're not going to get this Congress to impeach George Bush. But that shouldn't stop us from pushing the process forward. And we have one congressperson, John Conyers, who is serious about pushing that process forward. He wants 100,000 of us to sign up on his website, and he wants to get a letter of inquiry going within Congress. I say, let us support John Conyers, let us push the process as far as we can, and let us force the press in this country to even begin the discussion. Now, there is another discussion that has to begin in this country, and that is about withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. It is absolutely absurd that that discussion isn't even happening in this country, and that a month ago, when we had another vote for another $82 billion to continue this immoral, unjust war, we couldn't even get one senator in this country to vote against that and could only get 44 members of Congress. That is absolutely astounding, and that is a reflection on us, the people. Because we poured out our heart and soul to try to stop this war, we weren't able to do it. We poured out our heart and soul to try to stop George Bush from having another 4 years in the White House, we weren't able to do it, and then we got tired. We got tired, we got disillusioned, we got disempowered, we got cynical, and meanwhile the war is raging. And meanwhile our Congress people feel that they are off the hook, even many of the progressive ones. And so part of my reason going around on this book tour is to re-enthuse people who were with us in the beginning of saying no to the war and are now either disillusioned or many of them are genuinely confused. How many of you have a little voice in your head that says to you every once in a while, now that we're there, maybe it would be wrong to leave Iraq, maybe we should stay there, end quote, try to fix it. If you don't have it, you know a lot of people who have that voice. And these are good, genuine people coming from a very good place. And it even includes people like Howard Dean, who at a recent meeting of the ACLU said, I was against the war to begin with, but now that we are there. We have to convince people that that argument doesn't make any sense because there is no way we can, quote, fix things in Iraq. I have been there myself 5 times. I've seen every time I have gone there, things getting worse and worse and worse. And I'm absolutely convinced that they will not get better as long as the U.S. remains. That we don't know what will happen if the U.S. troops withdraw, but we know what will happen if they stay. And that is the violence will not stop and will only increase.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-editor of a new book, Stop the Next War Now, Effective Responses to Violence and Terrorism, published by Inner Ocean Publishing. For more information about Code Pink, call area code 310-827-4320 or visit their website at www.codepink4peace.org. Since suffering significant losses in the 2004 presidential election, progressive activists have been assessing their strengths and weaknesses and reconsidering strategies needed to build a movement that can effectively promote peace and social justice in the national debate and at the ballot box. Over 2,000 progressive political activists, academics, and commentators recently gathered in Washington, D.C. for the Take Back America conference, sponsored by the Campaign for America's Future. The conference, convened in early June, featured dozens of issue workshops and speeches from the likes of Democratic Party Chair Howard Dean, National Organization for Women President Kim Gandy, AFL-CIO President John Sweeney, and Public Television's Bill Moyers. Organizers of the conference hoped the gathering would be a catalyst for building the infrastructure needed to ensure the voice of the progressive majority is heard. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with veteran political organizer Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future. He talks about the political priorities discussed at the Take Back America conference, the largest gathering of progressives since the 2004 presidential election.
It was an exciting conference. We had about 2,000 people come through. They were filled with high energy. And what became clear was that progressives kind of came out of that election last fall not discouraged, but emboldened, and people are really making things happen at all levels of the country, and so that was pretty exciting to see. We had sessions on foreign policy, on what an economics is for, that works for working people, a big challenge to the Bush agenda, obviously. Laid out initiatives that are working at both the federal and the, more importantly, the state and local level, and moving forward. Look through the kitchen table issues that are a basic concern to Americans and which the Bush administration is really ignoring, and sort of went through political strategies of various sorts. So it was a terrific 3 days, and so there was a kind of sense of the beginnings of an alternative movement that had some real legs.
What was the most important thing that you think came out of the discussions held at this conference in terms of just ideas and strategies, coalition building, thinking about the 2006 election, which I think is critical in most people's view, even, of course, the Republicans who want to maintain power and others who want to break their iron grip on power in Washington? Anything come to mind as far as just important discussions and ideas that were hatched at the conference?
Well, I think you saw for the first time, you know, there's been real silence on progressives around the war in recent months, partly, I think, because of the election in November when everyone unified to try to take out Bush, partly because of the election in Iraq in January, which bought the president some time. And I think at this conference you saw the beginnings of a crystallizing position about setting a date to get the troops out and the beginnings of a movement to make that happen. And I think you'll see that burst into the public this fall. We did another major set of workshops and analysis of the Walmart economy and Walmart specifically. Robert Greenwald announced that he's doing a big film on Walmart, and as part of that is linking with workers and consumer groups and feminist groups and church groups and a whole range of communities about the damage Walmart is doing to this economy. And I think you're going to see the beginnings of a multi-level campaign to expose the choices involved in the Walmart economy and the choices involved specifically with this viciously anti-union employer named Walmart, which is, of course, America's largest employer. Then we did the kind of defining fights that are ongoing right now, Social Security and the fight over the packing of the courts, and laid out the next steps in those two critical campaigns. And so I think those were the big issues that, in terms of campaigning and coalition building, that people looked at.
Democratic pollster Stanley Greenberg, I believe, announced some interesting polling results about the national mood, national politics, and the possible future results of some elections around some key issues. What can you tell us about Stan Greenberg's poll there?
Yeah, the poll reflected what other polls are showing, which is Bush's popularity is sinking, that of the Republicans in Congress way down. The public strongly believes we're on the wrong track. They want a significantly different direction than that posed by the president. They have turned against his handling of Iraq, with the vast majority thinking it's not worth the cost, the same with his economic program and the same with his Social Security plan, which is now reached sort of rock bottom in terms of its acceptability. This is finally starting to have effect on Republicans in this kind of generic race against Democrats, where they're starting to sink. But more importantly, I think, in the poll, what we explored was kind of people's kind of fundamental attitudes about the conservative kind of agenda and ideology. And what we found was, in large numbers, Americans prefer an activist government than a government that gets out of the way and lets companies compete. They want regulation of corporations. They want regulation of trade and a government that stands up for America and the trading system. They are looking for investment in education and healthcare, not more tax cuts. It was a rather striking across-the-board rejection of the conservative philosophy of smaller government, lower taxes, less regulation, and the kind of sense that people are connecting the failures of this economy, which simply isn't working for working people, with those big conservative themes. And so that's a big opportunity for progressives, not simply to perhaps do better in the election next fall than people suspect, but in terms of really going on the offensive about defending an activist government and about the need to change our priorities and to make the investments we need to make this economy work again.
That was Robert Borisaj, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-955-5665 or visit their website at www.ourfuture.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world.
Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome your participation too. Please contact us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be bringing you our interview of local activist Bill Pagum on money for a sustainable community, and another episode of Down to Earth with New Hampshire environmentalist Jeff White. We leave you with this quote by Frederick Douglass. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its waters. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will.